With sports car racing news and analysis from around the globe, this is the Double Stint Podcast. Here's John DeGeese and Ryan Marine.
Hello, everyone. Welcome into Double Stint Sports Car 365 Sports Car Racing Podcast here in Indianapolis. I'm Ryan Marine. John DeGeese joining me from Chicago. And John, in years past, you would be joining me from somewhere near Le Mans, France at this time for this episode, as we are just past the originally scheduled date for the 2020 24 Hours of Le Mans. Of course, we know it's supposed to be held now in September. We did have the virtual Le Mans 24 over the weekend, and we'll talk about that in a moment. We've got plenty of news and some listener questions to get to as well. But, John, for me, there was still a void, even with the virtual Le Mans, and it was a very entertaining show, I must say, and we can get to that in a second. But just reflecting on a mid-June without the actual 24 hours, it's pretty strange to contemplate, and it was strange to live through.
Yeah, it's my first time in over 10 years being home in early to mid-June and not being in France. And like you said, some of that was sort of taken away by when we were covering the virtual 24 Hours of Le Mans, but it still wasn't the same. And I think everybody could sort of feel the same feeling. But it is what it is, and we have to hope that the race will go on in September as currently planned.
I guess in some respects, it was close enough to the real thing that it really left me feeling left out, right? Like we were close to having what I wanted to be watching over this weekend, and all credit to the organizers for getting us that close, but it maybe reminded me more about what I was missing than if it had been further wide of the mark, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, you know, what the ACO and Motorsport Games and everybody involved did to put on this virtual 24 Hours of Le Mans, they did as best of a job as physically and humanly possible, I think, to make it as close as it can be. You know, I was sort of reflecting how far sim racing has come in 20 years, having been sort of involved in it in the early days in the late 90s and early 2000s, and seeing it advance now where you had 170 connections all around the world, I think from 37 different countries connecting to this race on our factor. And yeah, there were glitches, and I'm sure we're going to get around to talking about that. But when you sort of take a step back and think about what was actually accomplished over the weekend, it's quite impressive. And, you know, like I said, it wasn't replacing the real thing to me. It still was leaving a void, but I think it was better than having nothing at all over the weekend. I think we would have been probably sorrowing more in our sadness if we, you know, didn't have something Le Mans related to watch and follow and report on.
So let's talk about the results here briefly. The battle for the overall win came down towards the very end in GTE. It was pretty well settled long before the final hour, but we did have some drama there with the Rebellion Williams team fighting with Baikalis in the final hour.
Yeah, it was quite cool to see the two longtime LMP1 privateers sort of battling it out for the win in the end. Obviously, they had different partners with them that helped make that happen. Rebellion had Williams Esports, which is a well-established esports team, an offshoot of the Formula One outfit. And then Baikalis had Burst, which was another more up-and-coming esports team. So Williams Esports drivers Kuba Bercheski and Nikodym Winineski joined Raffaele Marciello and Luis Delatraz in the winning Rebellion Williams entry, which basically led from the second half of the race onwards. We had some early challengers drop out or have server issues. I think the highest profile car to hit trouble in the race that was contending for the win was one of the Team Redline entries that featured F1 stars Max Verstappen and Lando Norris. Ultimately, Verstappen had a couple accidents. It looked like it could have been server-induced. I don't think he actually had them on his own. Hard to tell in the night in the sim, but ultimately that car was retired. It was later reinstated during one of the two red flag periods for a server reset, and I think we'll get to that a little bit later too. That caused a little confusion and maybe some frustration from drivers and people following the event. But yeah, it was cool to see the battle at the end because it did almost come down to a fuel mileage race. The Baikalis entry supported by Burst ended up with sort of reeling in the rebellion entry in the closing hours. I think there was a 40-second gap. It got reduced to 25, and one of the Baikal sim racers was closing in. Ultimately, it wasn't enough. If the race came down to another lap, it potentially could have swung into Baikal's hands due to that car making its final pit stop one lap later than the Rebellion. But nonetheless, it seemed pretty exciting. I know the commentators brought some great excitement to the battle, and it was good to see that there was some sort form of realism there with the cars battling it out. And it was good to see two of the stalwarts of the WEC have a representation in this, because if we saw some other entries, you know, no disrespect to some of the other teams that maybe weren't affiliated with a real life team, this sort of made it more realistic, at least, especially with some of the drivers.
I thought the opening portion of the race was especially entertaining because I believe there was a rule in place where they had to have real-life drivers in the cars at the start, and all of a, you're looking at the timing screen, and all these names are names that you're familiar with, and the team names, by and large, you had some interlopers, but many of the team names also were names that you were familiar with, and I found that to be quite compelling to go along with the TV presentation, and maybe we roll into some of the positives from over the weekend. I thought that was top of the list. They did a great job of taking it seriously. The presentation, clearly they spared no expense. It helps when you have real pros on the broadcast as well. And I've had the pleasure of working with Martin Haven and Min Constanduris before, plus some of the other names I think are familiar to many too. So I thought the TV presentation was as good as it gets, and it made the experience from home far more enjoyable than I feared it might be.
Yeah, the first few hours of the race, quite frankly, it felt almost like the real thing to me, and I was really blown away. It was extremely impressive, like you said, with the broadcast. I was really, really pumped. And heading into the race, I wasn't too optimistic. I was just a bit, you know, okay, let's see what happens. I'm getting a little tired of covering esports lately, because it seems like that's the only thing that's going on, and I think we all want to get back to real racing. And we see that on the horizon. We see that with some racing restarting. So I was sort of left with mixed feelings, but as the race started, I got really into it. And like you said, Ryan, the first hour it was required that the real life drivers had to be in the car. And I think that added a lot to it as well. And if we saw a bunch of sim racers, no disrespect to them, but they're obviously in their own element. They're in their own field. They have, quite arguably, most of them were probably faster than the real life drivers, bar a couple professional real life race car drivers that were in the race. But I think just from a visibility standpoint, it made a lot of sense to have those drivers in for the opening stint and a half. And quite frankly, it would have been cool to maybe have that rule for the last hour of the race as well. I think that might have added a little bit more of a dynamic as well. A little bit more difficult to implement, obviously, with everybody on different strategies and whatnot. You know, I don't know what they would have been able to do. Maybe a final stint, you know, your final pit stop, you have to switch over to a real life driver, but then other people can lengthen their stints and have the real life driver only do a few laps. I don't know, but it is what it is. I think that, you know, the rules, the organization, it was as best as it could be, and it definitely put on a show. And I guess if you took a step back and sort of looked at it more from an entertainment value, I think it was by far and large a great value for all involved.
I think now if we transition to some of the negatives over the weekend, really there weren't all that many, and they come down to technical issues by and large. The two red flags that you mentioned earlier, those are the most glaring, and probably the ones that I view mostly in a negative light. Some of the other things where drivers were having issues with their equipment, maybe that stands in for some of the bad luck that happens in a real-world race, a tire puncture or something, electronics gremlin on a race car. These things you have to deal with over the course of 24 hours. And, you know, seeing Simon Pagenaud, for instance, switching sim rigs mid-race, that was pretty fascinating. And you know, that to me did not detract so much from the show. But when you have the enforced stoppages and some of the ways that impacted the race itself, that we saw, especially when we came into this event with the servers for R Factor 2 being maybe a bit of a known issue, a red flag coming into the event. Those, to me, are a bit hard to get past, and frankly, were a bit of a black eye on an otherwise really stellar event over the weekend.
Yeah, I think that's really the only negative I saw from the weekend, and it was just sort of the server issues and how particularly they were handled. The first one came, I think, in the fourth or fifth hour, and ultimately it stirred up a bit of controversy on social media, and I was right in the middle of it too. I'll be the first to admit, it you know, for what it looked like initially, okay, server issue, you have to restart. It took about a half an hour to get things going again, but the decision by the organizers was made to allow the Fernando Alonso led FARB All In Sports entry back into the race. Now, this car was an entry that had run out of fuel on track earlier on, had only completed 9 laps. And what later became apparent to all of us was that it ran out of fuel on track due to a penalty that was issued to the car that it served before it could refuel. And that's why Fernando ended up running out of fuel. It wasn't a mistake by the team or the strategist. It was just sort of an anomaly with the sim. And I could understand that part for sure. But questions on why they just got a freebie to get back in the game. Fernando was already on a bike ride. He was already checked out. And then all of a sudden they let him back in. And not only that, they gave him 60 laps back from where they were. And quite frankly, that's the thing that frustrated me the most. It's like, how did that happen? And where was that in the rules and regulations? And quite frankly, I couldn't find anything that said that kind of procedure would happen. And we had a second red flag later on in the race, I think about 14 hours later, and also for a server reset. And that time they let back in the Lando Norris and Max Verstappen car. And again, you can argue these are high profile entries. They're letting back in with huge followers on their Twitch streams. And, you know, the red line entry that had led the race earlier had retired on their own merit. They didn't run out of fuel. They retired, they announced it on Twitter. And then all of a sudden they were let back in for the final 10 hours, even though they decided to call it quits a number of hours earlier. So those are the kind of questions I had. You know, I understand the organizers were under an immense pressure, lots of unknowns going into the event. And I think a lot of these things had to sort of be acted on the fly. And what may have looked as, you know, controversial may have not really been, but it just sort of was perceived that way by some people. And I think that's what sort of put a little dampening on this whole event, that it, you know, these resets led to more some controversy, and also the fact that everybody was reset. Everybody had fresh cars. The damage didn't carry over. The fuel didn't carry over. And, you know, arguably, if this race had been contested on iRacing, I don't think we would have had these issues. You know, both you and I, Ryan, have been through 24-hour races on the iRacing platform. Never had a server reset. Never had any kind of, like, catastrophic issue. We've had, you know, there's issues of iRacing's sim themselves, you know, with ghosting problems and other, you know, glitches that happen understandably in online racing. And there were some of those with this too. And again, I understand the ACO's decision with going with R Factor. I think it did make more sense to have that because there were more cars available, more Le Mans up-to-date cars like the Aston Martin, the Orica and LMP2. And then also you had a Corvette representation. So I think it made sense, but now I think it's time for, you know, either iRacing to step up and offer more cars for a potential repeat of this next year, maybe on the iRacing platform, or for developers to really get over some of these bugs and glitches, you know, to sort of have a more flawless run next time if we were to do this. I think that was my only disappointment from the weekend, is just, you know, everything was taken so seriously and everything was so done so realistically, yet we had some, quite frankly, arcade-ish outcomes due to the technical flaws in the system. And while sim racing has come such a long way, you would have hoped that they could have run a 24-hour race without any kind of server resets, and I think that would have changed the scope of the race quite a bit.
Yeah, I think as far as it is the reinstatements of otherwise retired or what have you cars goes, I think you brought it up, the dichotomy of how serious everyone was taking this, from the entry list to having Michelin put out a press release that they're going to be the official tire supplier of the race. Everything was done like you would do for the real 24 hours of Le Mans, and then all of a sudden that gets thrown out the window in the middle. And I understand the server errors, maybe there's nothing you can do about that, but the way that you handle them, that can be affected by people in real time. So, yeah, a little disappointed in that. I get the idea that you're trying to draw attention and you want the big-name teams and drivers to be a part of it. And at the end of the day, I don't know how much of an effect it had on the ultimate outcome, but I share your disappointment with some of that. My hope is that the FIA sees the value of this and the WEC sees the value of esports, and maybe they link up with a developer like what we've seen from the SRO and the Kunos folks, who put together Assetto Corsa to have an official game so you can have all of the manufacturers represented and do it maybe in a better way moving forward. But given the circumstances, I know it was a monumental effort just to put this event on in the first place. The positives way outweigh the negatives from where I sit. Like I said, the broadcast was immensely entertaining. Kudos to them as well for all of the high-profile interviews they were able to wrangle up during that show. That was a ton of fun to see some of the legends like Jackie Ickx and Henri Pescarolo, Mario Andretti, Roger Penske, all of these big names that were a part of the broadcast. I thought that was really cool as well. And yeah, there were some downsides, but in the end, it's a net gain, I think, both for esports, but also for endurance racing. Hopefully it brought a few more eyeballs to the sport and to the event that will follow along when we get to the real race, hopefully in September. Any final thoughts from you, John, before we move on?
Yeah, not much more other than it was a great event. I agree with you fully, Ryan. I was really impressed by Porsche's pace in GTE. It seemed like they really came out in force with their entries. Very well could have locked out the podium had there not been some issues during the driver changes. They had some server issues there, unfortunately. Quite a few cars actually had problems with that during the driver changes with the software. But again, you know, looking at outweighing the positives to the negatives, I think we had an incredible event overall, and I think it definitely satisfied some of our withdrawals from Le Mans right now, for sure, withdrawal symptoms.
And we did have a 24-hour race over the weekend in real life and in Europe. We had Kreventic back in action with the 24 hours of Portimao. Little disappointed that there weren't more cars, but I certainly understand the circumstances made that difficult. I think it was 15 that were on the entry list there, and at the end of 24 hours, Herberth Motorsport picked up the 1-2 finish in that race. We've got a race recap at sportscar365.com if you'd like more about that.
Yeah, Ryan, it was quite surreal to see another 24-hour race in real life go on almost at the same time as the virtual Le Mans, and this time it was the Kreventic's 24-hour series back in action. And like you said, it wasn't as big of a grid as we expected or had hoped for, but I think, you know, all things considered, it was really cool to see real racing return to Europe, and this was the first international sports car race to happen since the pandemic started. So I think kudos to everybody at Kreventic for getting this off the ground and sort of being the pace setters here with this and the trailblazers in Europe for having a properly sanctioned endurance event in June. And I think that just goes to show you that when there's a will, there's a way. And you know, sure, it wasn't the most exciting race, but at least racing is back underway, and this sort of helps, you know, signal that for international competition, especially sports car racing.
Amen to that. Well, let's transition then to the news of the week now. And starting in IMSA, a couple of teams with Canadian roots, AIM with Vassar Sullivan as well as FAF, have been on the record with us, John, talking about the potential challenges for Canadian staff, and in the case of FAF, a Canadian team in its entirety, making that trip from Canada to the U.S. with some of the restrictions that are in place right now. It seems like the AVS side of things, they're pretty optimistic that it's not going to challenge them, but actually have come up with some interesting ways to handle the challenges. Meanwhile, FAF, with so much of its infrastructure being in Canada, basically everything, I think it's going to be a bit more difficult for them. Can you lay out the challenges that each of them face and how they plan on moving forward?
Yeah, it's an interesting situation, Ryan, with the Canadian teams in particular. And this is something I didn't realize until speaking with Steve Bortolotti, from the team manager from FAF Motorsports, that the border is still technically closed between the U.S. and Canada, and that's through at least June 21st. Latest reports indicate that that's likely to be extended into July, and that's where this holdup sort of comes into place. Right now, through IMSA's work with the Department of Homeland Security, teams are able to get waivers, exemptions to cross the border, because just like the drivers and other personnel coming in from Europe, a similar procedure is in place. And this is one of the ways that Ambassador Sullivan will be taking part in the races with their Canadian crew. I spoke to Ian Willis, one of the team owners of that operation, and he told me, I think roughly 55% of their team are Canadian nationals. And at one point, they had considered keeping their Canadians back home at their workshop and actually hiring additional U.S. crew to fly in for the races and having their transporter go back and forth between Canada and the U.S. between races, and having their Canadian staff service the cars in the Toronto area at their workshop. But ultimately, he doesn't think it'll have to come to that. He feels pretty confident they'll be able to fly in and out their crew members and not have to serve the 14-day quarantine on either end of the spectrum. So right now, anybody entering Canada must quarantine for 14 days as it stands today. And if you enter the U.S., it's recommended you quarantine for 14 days. It's not entirely enforced. So that's where these lines are a little blurred, and teams are taking different approaches and different interpretations of these rules. AVS doesn't think they'll have to serve the quarantine on either end. The U.S., obviously, as I said, is recommended. It's not enforced. And in Canada, while it is required, Ian told me that they don't believe they have to, since they're considered an essential service or will be getting those exceptions from the government authorities to travel. Speaking to Steve Bortolotti from FAF, he believes that they would have to quarantine on the way back, and they wouldn't want to take the risk and not quarantine. And in FAF's situation, I think it's all but three of their crew members are full-time workers in the company's various dealerships throughout Canada. And quarantining, you know, it just doesn't make business sense for anybody if they have to do that. And so it ultimately, the only way FAF will return to IMSA competition, Steve told me, is that if the borders are officially opened and there are no quarantines. So as it looks right now, it's looking pretty unlikely we'll be seeing the FAF Porsche of Zachary Robichon and Dennis Olsen for Daytona or Sebring. Hopefully we could see him later in the year. Steve made a mention that, you know, if things were case scenario occurs and there's further delays in the border being open, they may just focus on the endurance races at the tail end of the year and then come back even stronger in 2021. So that's a bit of a setback, I think, a bit of a disappointing news. I completely respect FAF's decision to play it safe and respect all of the current government recommendations or mandates. Not saying that AVS isn't, it's just sort of a gray area over how all this is happening right now. And it's interesting to note that, you know, I think that each Canadian team is sort of taking different approaches. We also have Compass Racing, which plans to contest all the WeatherTech Sprint Cup races. There's hopefully some news on that on Sports Car 365 by the time this is published on their efforts to make it into the U.S. and contest with their McLaren program in GTD. So you also have other Canadian outfits like Multimatic, which is taking over the Mazda program once they return to racing in Daytona in July. And that group is largely international, not just Canadian, but there are some Canadians involved there too, including Larry Holt. So stay tuned. I think so far it seems to be affecting teams in different ways.
All right, so it sounds like there's a chance we may be without the FAF Porsche in GTD when things resume. We know that we'll be without Paul Mueller Racing when we get to the track on 4th of July weekend and again in the subsequent makeup race that they have scheduled in July for Sebring. What's behind Paul Mueller's decision to skip these two events coming up next month?
Yeah, it basically comes down to Paul's line of dealerships that have its staff largely furloughed right now. I had a pretty long conversation with Paul last week about this, and he was really straight up with me in saying that it doesn't look right, it doesn't feel right to go racing when my workers, my staff, and our car dealerships are not able to be back and fully reinstated and back to full-time work right now due to the pandemic and that's been ongoing. And where his dealerships are located, they're all in New Jersey. That's one of the hardest hit states in the U.S. right now with terms of government lockdowns and whatnot. The state actually just came out of lockdown last week, believe it or not, where most of the country has sort of been in different phases of reopening, over the last, I'd say, month or so. So New Jersey is still really just getting out of things right now, and it's not so good right now for his business with his line of dealerships. And Paul basically said that they're not going to go racing until things clear up on that front, and he hopes to have the car back on track later in the year, but there's no guarantees. He confirmed to me their entire team has been furloughed as well, the race team. So hoping we get some good news there. He said they basically need to have a decision 30 days out from the next event they would enter. So if they were to make it to Road America, we would sort of have a better idea by early July on whether that'll happen or not. But I think the way the things stand right now, it's probably looking unlikely. And it'll be a real shame not to see the Daytona winners on the grid back at Daytona in July, especially from Lamborghini's standpoint after coming off such a strong race at the 24-hour in January.
Yeah, that's a good point. And speaking of Lamborghini, some more positive news from that manufacturer. They've stepped up to the plate to join Ferrari and Mercedes-AMG as a global GT World Challenge manufacturer. So maybe we got to back up first and remind ourselves, what does this mean in the first place, and then what might the implications of this move be?
Yeah, so Global GT World Challenge is basically a manufacturer's championship that awards points based on each team's finishing order and results from the different GT World Challenges around the world in Europe, Asia, and America. Last year, we had Mercedes-AMG and Ferrari take part in this manufacturer's championship. Mercedes-AMG ended up winning it. Don't ask me how or why or how many points, because it was extremely, extremely difficult to follow. And adding another layer of complexity will be Lamborghini joining this, because it doesn't appear Lamborghini will actually have an entry in the American series, in GT World Challenge America. It seems that they'll only be scoring points in Europe and Asia, which is fine by me. It's great to have another manufacturer involved, but I don't know exactly how this is going to work. It hasn't been laid out on the points. Maybe it's the best two of the three series this year. We don't know. We're still trying to get clarification on this, so hopefully we get some news soon, but still good to see Lamborghini joining this championship, is world challenge per se, where they take some drivers from each series and put them together. Last year it was supposed to be a bronze, a silver, a gold, and a platinum, and then those rules got changed in the middle of the year when some manufacturers didn't have some of those rated drivers eligible in some of the championships, and then you had some teams withdrawing in the middle of the year, and it made for an extremely complicated situation. I totally get Stefan Reitel's idea of this world challenge by promoting the privateers of, customers of all these GT3 manufacturers. But I kind of wish there was an easier way to explain it to fans, or even for us just to understand how it works. But nonetheless, there are three manufacturers registered for GT World Challenge Global this year.
Yeah, that's the important thing to take away from this, I think. And to your point about the complexity, I had a driver texting me this past week asking for it to be explained, and I went and explained it all and realized they've changed all the rules since last year. So anything I thought I knew is no longer the case. And anyway, I'm doing my best to stay on top of it, but I guess the end of the of the topic is it's good news to have Lamborghini involved, and hopefully maybe that means that they will take some interest in GT World Challenge America down the road, but doesn't sound like anything is imminent on that front. However, we do know that we are edging closer to GT World Challenge Europe resuming, and Stefan Rattel has been speaking recently about the prospects for the upcoming season, and despite all the difficulties, he does seem rather optimistic about the health of the grid and the fact that they should be able to get a pretty representative season put together here when we do get the green flag on the season in a little while.
Yeah, SRO reconfirmed their calendar last week with all three GT World Challenge series, and believe it or not, despite all the rescheduled races, there is not a single conflicting weekend between any of those regional series. So that's a great accomplishment in its own. Again, these are all subject to change, and quite frankly, I bet we will have a change or two still before all this is said and done. But right now, as you said, Ryan, GT World Challenge Europe is set to restart first for their first round of the season at Imola. And I think the spot, which would have been the Spa 24 Hours weekend in late July, that'll be the first race back. And then I believe America will be up next at VIR in a few weeks' time after that. That'll be the second weekend of the year for SRO America following the COTA event that both of us were at back in March. So, actually the most recent races we saw in person before all this lockdown happened. Nonetheless, I think Stefan seems quite bullish on the prospects, like you said, Ryan. He doesn't sound like there's that many teams that have withdrawn. He thinks the grids are still going to be really good in Europe. Some question marks on Asia, difficulty scheduling those races. We've had some revisions in the calendar there, where basically they took out the Japanese rounds due to the current situation in Japan with barring entry for a lot of nationalities. So it's difficult to sort of predict where everything is going to happen. But I think if we don't see a major secondary outbreak of the pandemic, I think that we'll largely get in the majority of the World Challenge races. And it's going to be a busy second half of the year for sure.
More on those topics, plus other stories like Multimatic forming a new special vehicle operations arm under which its racing programs now fall, and also the confirmation that Scott Dixon will be rejoining Wayne Taylor Racing for Petit Le Mans and the WeatherTech Championship season finale this year at Sebring. You can find more on those topics and a whole lot more at sportscar365.com. Let's close the show with some listener questions. This first one, it's an interesting one from Duke of Hazard, and these are his words, or her words, but seeing as it's Duke and not Duchess, we're going to go with he. He writes, "Who knows, now that the continually BOP-blessed whiners from Stuttgart are leaving, other manufacturers might consider joining." He says Porsche made a mockery of this class with their insistence on running what was effectively a prototype as a GT car. The rules enforcers were stupid to allow it, and the collapse and support in support of GTLM was an inevitable result. A couple thoughts here before I turn it over to you, John. I'd say that the precedent had been set long before Porsche ran a 911 that was not in the same configuration as its road-going variant with the Ford GT for running effectively a prototype as a GT car, and I think you can find other examples down through history as well. As far as whining about BOP, look, that's just the nature of the sport, right? If you're a manufacturer in the sport, a driver in the sport, you've got to do your lobbying, and maybe some do it more vocally than others. But frankly, as long as you have BOP, you're going to be having some of this, and I'm not sure that one manufacturer does it more vociferously than others, at least not to a huge degree. Not that it's nice to hear, and it does get old, but you know, that's just the nature of racing in this era. Any thoughts from you, John?
Yeah, I think you summed up my thoughts almost perfectly there, Ryan. We see a number of examples, which you could sort of call prototypes in a GT field, the Ford being one of them, the BMW being another one, the M8. Also, Porsche to some extent, yeah. And that does leave Ferrari and Corvette and potentially Aston with more true GT cars, but then again, the roots of their cars, their road cars, are more GT based, So there's an argument that could be said across the board for those anyway. I don't think that Porsche was the first. By far and large, they're not going to be the last. And these are the rules. They're not getting exceptions to the rules. There's no waivers to allow the placement of the engine, for instance. So I don't think we should be arguing about that. In terms of BOP, yeah, same thing. I think that we're seeing the ACO, the FIA, IMSA do their best job as possible to get these cars as close as possible. But I think what we saw last year was a really strong performance from Porsche. And yeah, there was some controversy. Yeah, people were questioning why they were winning every race. But you look at some of the races in the IMSA season, and they weren't the quickest car at every track. A lot of other cars had problems, and that's why you go racing. You go out and see what happens in a race. And just like we saw virtually last weekend, there were cars that ran into problems. And, there was BOP, people complaining about the BOP
that's
in the
right.
virtual world last weekend too. So it's like, you're never going to please anybody. And, hate to say it, but those are my thoughts. I don't know.
And I think that the notion that somehow Porsche withdrawing would entice other manufacturers to join, I hate to be so dismissive, but I don't think that there's anything to that, frankly. If anything, it would scare manufacturers away from GTE because it just calls into greater question the viability of the platform moving forward. So, yeah, I'm not sure I'm quite on board with this, Duke of Hazzard. We appreciate your input, and you're welcome to write in again. And thank you for the question, or I guess comment in this case, and we hope to hear from you in the future. A couple other questions, both on basically the same topic here, John, so I'll read them both and turn it over to you. First comes from Matt at Sports Car Racing Every Day, who says, for the FIA WEC LMH regs, he says he hasn't read anywhere in the rules preventing an auto company like Multimatic, Orica, Ginetta, etc. from purchasing a car like the McLaren Senna for GT Mark II or Porsche 918 and modifying the cars to suit the LMH rules. He says, do these auto companies need permission as such from the manufacturer to modify and race these cars? And if so, should this permission be relaxed or negated to let these teams modify existing sports cars on the market to take to the WEC? Second comment from @ATFlorio on Twitter, kind of along the same lines, just with GT cars, saying, seeing as how IMSA classifies their GT3 class as their own GTD class, couldn't IMSA let them ignore the customer car rule and have the C8R just be an IMSA GTD car, i.e. not SRO GT3 car, thinking in terms of the Maserati GT1 back in the ALMS days. So at the crux of this, I think, is do you see sanctioning bodies opening their rules a little bit, adding some wiggle room given the circumstances we're in, and more specifically on the LMH side of things, can a private constructor or tuner or what have you take something from an existing company and turn it into an LMH car without any kind of permission?
I think you need permission from the manufacturer to do that. And more importantly, the way I understand it is that production-based LMH cars are most likely no longer eligible in LMH. So what Aston Martin was planning to build with their Valkyrie, what they were planning to race with their production-based Valkyrie to go up against a prototype-based Toyota, I don't think that's possible anymore, because that would not have been possible to balance those cars and the prototype hypercars and LMDH altogether. So I think that's what we've seen with Convergence, is that Convergence right now is LMDH and prototype Le Mans hypercar, and the production-based Le Mans hypercar, I believe, is dead. Now, don't quote me on that. We have to get that confirmed, but that's the way I understand it. So having a third-party constructor or competitor purchase a road-going Senna or Ford GT or Porsche or whatever, that just won't work, because you have to build a car around a carbon fiber monocoque, a prototype effective regulations. So I think that's the best explanation that we have right now for that. And in regards to GT3, yeah, I guess anything's possible on that for the Corvette, but I think it's quite easy to convert this Corvette C8R, the GTE spec car, to GT3, that I don't think GM would have any hesitation to do it. There's not much really required based on what I know. So I don't think it would make sense for IMSA to make special exceptions. They have in the past, you know, like you mentioned, the Maserati. More recently, I think the BMW Z4. No, Z4 was homologated, but the M6, they had an M6 version that ran on GTLM that was IMSA only. That was prior to the M8 running in full GTE configuration. So, there's been times that's happened. And again, it wouldn't surprise me if IMSA were to do that. But I think GM would be much smarter to actually just homologate a C8R as a GT3 car. That way there's a potential for customer sales and global competition.
I guess that would be under the assumption that they're interested in customer sales, which always was a negative when it came to the Cadillac GT3 program. So could this be a workaround to get away from customer sales? I suppose it could, but, you know, this would be bringing what would truly be a factory program into GT3 and IMSA, which is GTD, and I suppose maybe in the future we're having a Pro and an AM class with GT3 cars, but at the moment I'm not sure that's what IMSA would like to see, so I'm not sure that it's in IMSA's best interest not to kind of shoehorn Chevy into going the full-on GT3 route.
Yeah, I would agree, and again, this is all just speculation on what we think could happen, because nothing's been confirmed yet in terms of the future of GTLM or the GTE platform. But yes, it would make common sense for IMSA to sort of scrap it for next year and run GT3-based cars in both Pro and AM. And that does leave the question where Corvette would go. But I'm sure there would be a way to accommodate them one way or another.
Yeah, so I guess the ultimate answer to the question is yes, IMSA could let them ignore that customer car rule and have it be an IMSA-only GT3 car, but I'm not sure that's the direction that they would go, but interesting to think about for sure. All right, thanks to everyone for writing in with their questions and comments. We'll take questions and comments for future shows as well. You can leave them in the comment section or get at us on Twitter using the hashtag AskDoubleStick. That's it for us this week. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next week with our next edition of the show.